present to you some work that my colleagues and I have been doing, where our intention is to develop some sort of methodology that allows us to do systematic synthesis and analysis of collective motion. So on the engineering side, so we're interested both in engineered and natural collectives. And we're very strongly motivated from the engineering side, where we're interested in synthesizing collective motions, where we can have some notion that what we expect is going to happen will actually happen. And in particular, we're interested in applications to mobile sensor networks. So here, each individual agent is actually a moving sensor platform, and the goal then is to figure out how to synthesize rules or algorithms or forces and torques on these sensor platforms so that they organize themselves in ways to collect data in an optimal way, meaning, for instance, an optimally rich, maximally rich data set that will be useful for various purposes. We're also interested in the natural setting in the sense that the models that we develop to synthesize behavior may potentially be useful, we hope will be useful, in contributing to perhaps analysis of data from biology or perhaps exploring some of the mechanisms that link individual behavior to group behavior. Of course, we have kind of an extra motivation in that what we learn from biology can potentially be useful in what we do in the engineering setting, even if it's simply understanding what the parameter ranges in our algorithms that are going to be best suited to types of activities that we want to do are. But also just learning better how natural groups are able to robustly move around in these big groups and how they're able to do that under very trying circumstances, such as we have in the ocean, for instance, which is quite valuable. So this work, we have a lot of different kinds of activities going on. I'm going to focus on one line of research, and this research is in collaboration with Derek Paley, who's a graduate student working with me at Princeton, and Rodolphe Sapolker, who's a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Liège in Belgium. But I also want to acknowledge a lot of other people because I will discuss some other pieces of the work. In particular, I'll talk about some work we're doing with Danny on his fish data and some other work we're doing with Ian and Simon Levin on their models of leadership in animal aggregations. The people here, so everybody here has contributed in one way or another to the work that I'm going to describe. Funa is here. I had a poster yesterday. I'll talk a little bit about that. Francois is another postdoc working with me at Princeton. These are graduate students, and these are either current or former undergraduates. I do a lot of work with oceanographers. I have a big program in adaptive ocean sampling, and these are three oceanographers who have been most inspirational. Dave is the collaborator, so any of the experimental work you see, he's the guy who we collaborate with. He's the guy who owns these gliders. These are underwater gliders that we use for ocean sampling. Pierre is an ocean modeler at Harvard who does big ocean forecasting models. Okay, so on the engineering side, the goal is to coordinate this group of individually controlled systems. And I like to think about them as a mobile sensor network, so each individual isn't just moving around for fun. They want, as a group, to collectively perform some kind of task. So in our case, in mobile sensor networks, typically the idea is to collect the best data set. So we're talking about robotic sensor platforms that move out on their own. They do their own thing. They run on batteries, so they have limited resources. So you want to take account of that and take advantage of the fact that you have limited time, and so you want to do the best that you can do given this limited time that your batteries last while you're out there. So the kinds of activities that, actually complementary activities that we focus on are at kind of two different scales. So we're interested in what we think of as a feature tracking problem. where you might use, say, here's a little cluster of four individuals that are working together to track a level set. So what you're looking at here is a plot of temperature. This is actually a plot of temperature on August 13th, 2003 in Monterey Bay, California. And it's quite a noisy field. And each one of these individuals can only measure temperature right where it is at a given time. It can't measure a gradient by itself. And yet what this algorithm is doing is it's collectively estimating a gradient. It's also estimating the curvature of a level curve. So I can't remember, Fuhlman is something like 14.25 degrees Celsius, the line that this is Fuhlman's movie that it's tracking. And he's done the color maps to kind of accentuate the line that he's following. But this is a very noisy field, so they're using estimation. They're also changing their shape, so they're changing the resolution of their collective as sensor array in response to what they're measuring in the field, so that they do the best job and minimize the error in the estimates of the gradient, so they can do the best job in tracking. Sort of at the other end of the spectrum, we're also interested getting the synoptic picture. So we go into the ocean with our mobile sensors, and we want to be able to make sure that we don't miss anything. So we both have to sort of hone in on features that are going to be interesting and tell us something about the dynamics, but we have to make sure we have a picture of what's going on in general over space and time. And so this is actually, again, we do a lot of work at Monterey Bay, California. So this is, so Santa Cruz is right around here. So the green is land, the white is the ocean. And this is showing you, this is actually a virtual pilot experiment where we're looking at a box that's 20 kilometers by 40 kilometers. There are, there's 10 gliders being controlled here according to a pattern that was designed to do a good job with respect to the dominant spatial and temporal scales of interest. So here we're looking for patterns, we're looking to control our individual guys into patterns so that we are maximizing information with respect to scales of interest. So for instance, we don't want these guys to get closer than some kind of dominant spatial scale, else they risk becoming redundant. They don't want to get too far away, else they miss something important in between. They don't want to revisit a spot too frequently, else they become redundant. But they don't want to visit too occasionally, else they miss some information. So there's some kind of optimal, this is actually our measure of sampling performance. Information in a derogenous way. Okay, so it's really this activity, the algorithms that we've derived to create these, synthesize these kinds of patterns that I'm going to talk about today. First, I just want to show you a little bit more of this motivation, because this project is quite inspiring. What we do, as I work with a large number of oceanographers and ecologists, and the goal is to not just collect interesting data that people pore over, but actually to collect data, and in real time, the data that gets collected from our mobile sensors is getting sent up to a number of these ocean modelers who assimilate. We have three models that run in real time. They assimilate the data into their models, and they update their forecasts. So we can get nowcasts, we can get 1, 2, 3 day forecasts of temperature fields, salinity fields, currents, which actually can then be fed back into what the gliders are doing. So we have this sort of big loop where the goal is to sort of improve our ability to estimate or predict what's going on in the ocean. So there's lots of interest and understanding. For instance, when we went to Monterey Bay, California in 2003, the interest was in trying to develop better biology, physics coupled models, so understanding what the phytoplankton patches were doing in response to what the temperature gradients looked like, what the currents were doing, what the salinity was like. And to do that, we needed good data. And so this is our big loop. You know, these guys are doing their thing, trying to respond both to the ocean, maybe to what we're learning from the models about what's coming. And the data is getting assimilated into these ocean models, and we have this big loop. This is a little movie, just so you can see. Whoopsie. That's another movie. Oops. So this is a little movie, just so you can see what one of these gliders looks like. So these are really nice sensor platforms. They stay in the water continuously for weeks because they don't have propellers. They're buoyancy driven. So they change their volume so they can go up and down. They have little wings so they get lift. So they do this kind of motion. You can redistribute mass on board, so you can make them roll and turn, so you can move around in 3D, and they're slow. They're endurance vehicles, but they're slow. So we have, one of our big challenges, which I'm not going to talk about, is dealing with the currents, because they can go slower than the currents in Monterey Bay sometimes. But I'll show you what we've done despite the currents. But I just want to show you this little movie, just so you get a feel for sort of how simple these things are. They're a meter and a half long. They don't weigh very much. You just push them off the back of the boat, and then you don't see them for a month. And this data comes streaming in. It's pretty phenomenal.
These things don't communicate with each other anymore.
Well, what they do do, because what we do is make them move around as a collective. So they're moving around, and they're several kilometers away from one another. So they don't communicate with one another. We have trade-offs between, because we have to save battery power, putting acoustic modems on board at the moment would be too much of a memory hog. We pack them with science sensors instead. But what we do is instead have an onshore computer where we sort of play the cooperative game here. So we're essentially having any guy, when he surfaces, the guys surface every couple of hours, they get GPS, and they send their data back through Iridium satellite, and that eventually comes to the onboard computer, and that gets, so that's where we get our feedback. And then when they're up there, they can also get new mission instructions. So the next couple hours, they do very low-level control to sort of follow what they're supposed to do.
Do they all come up at the same time?
No, they don't all come up at the same time. So we have this sort of constant estimation and planning. So actually, in this context, the point models are really important, the particle models, because we can't just literally control them by themselves to respond to what their neighbors are doing. We control it sort of as like a trajectory design problem, and then send those trajectories down. So it's this somewhat crippled, but I'll show you in the next slide.
But how much do they drift? I mean, I guess it depends on the current. Because, I mean, you give them, you tell them what to do, and then they go off and do it, and then they come back, and they're not really exactly where you hope they were.
They're pretty good, because what they do is they use themselves as flow meters. So they have an estimate, a running estimate of what the flow is. So they come up, they think they know what they are, because they're doing dead reckoning underwater. They get GPS, they estimate their linear velocity, they integrate, they come up, they think they know where they are. All along, they've been trying to follow points in space, or cylinders in space, because they're moving up and down. And when they come up, they think they know where they are, they find out where they really are, they attribute all the error to, you know, a mismatch in what they thought the current was, and they take this vector divided by delta t, for instance, and just for the next cycle, they take that as the average local current. So they do a pretty good job. So this is the job that they did, at least what we were able to do in 2003. This was our first try ever at doing something in the ocean with this kind of collective motion. And I'm showing you two different sea trials that we did during the month of August. So we had a fleet, pretty large fleet. Maybe at any given time there are as many as 13 gliders in the water in and around Monterey Bay. And we ran these little sea trials where we would pick off three of the gliders and have them do some maneuvers. And the first case, this was on August 6th and 7th, we had them move in a triangle formation up. There was a big upwelling event when minerals were about to rise and all the phytoplankton was about to attack. So that we were driving them up there anyway, and we decided to drive them up in a triangle and experiment with our ability to control them in a triangle, and also with our ability to estimate gradients. In this case, we're estimating temperature gradients. So here we are controlling these guys. They're roughly 3 kilometers apart from one another as they move in this kind of northwest direction. And the color map is temperature, degrees C. And so you see these are snapshots of where these guys were at these different times. So this is about 12 hours of our run. And so this guy is measuring something cold, something warm. And so the vector corresponds to minus the gradient of temperature at 10 meters depth. And so what was really exciting for us actually was how smooth this estimate of the gradient was. People said, there's no way you're going to make any sense out of, you know, three measurements. And not only that, it was actually pointing towards the cold water. So when we said, you know, I'm standing there in the control, I'm saying, look, you know, it's pointing to the cold water. And the oceanographer looked at me and said, well, Naomi, we know the cold water's there. And I said, well, that was the whole point. You know, these guys are supposed to be able to, you know, you're not always going to be standing there telling us everything about Monterey Bay. But, you know, the big goal is to create a sustainable, portable observing system. So this was kind of exciting for us. This is another sea trial where we were trying to demonstrate not just the ability to move in a triangle, but we're trying to show that we can change resolution. So here, the center of mass, so each yellow dot is a glider. So this is actual data, again, from the 2003, this was on August 16th. So again, on the order of about 12 hours to do this. Each yellow dot is a glider, and you see this little purple symbol here is the center of mass of the actual guys, and it's trying to follow this prescribed line. And we first had the triangle expand to 6 kilometer spacing and then shrink to 3 kilometer spacing, and all the while having the center of mass follow the line. And we also rotated the triangle so that one edge was always normal to the path. So this was pretty exciting because the currents got huge down here. These guys moved something like 40 centimeters per second relative to the flow, and the currents were like 35 centimeters per second. So, you know, you could see sometimes when one guy's kind of stuck, the triangle would kind of turn and go with the flow, essentially. So meanwhile, the other gliders were not being adapted in any way. They were sort of following predefined racetracks. So they weren't being adapted, and they weren't being controlled as a collective. So they weren't being coordinated. And so what we set out to do here was to think about how to evaluate. This is, again, in August 2003. You're looking at a movie. Maybe just look on the left. This is just a blow-up of what's on the left. So here, green, so this is Monterey Bay. The white is the water. Every black dot is a glider. The white dots are where the glider was over the last few hours. The color map corresponds to a measure, sort of statistical uncertainty in our, like a linear estimate of the field. So this is uncertainty or error in our ability to estimate temperature given this notion of dominant spatial and temporal scales, and given where all these guys are going, how well can we estimate it? This is the uncertainty. So blue corresponds to low uncertainty or high information, and red corresponds to high uncertainty and low information. So you can see, of course, it's blue right around where we're collecting data, but as you move away, it's not so certain what's going on. But what's interesting is that you can, this plot right here, this is a plot of basically performance or information for every snapshot here. So this is performance as a function of days. Every snapshot here is a different day. And so when you see these dells, you know, this thing drops for some reason, it corresponds over here to them collecting where they shouldn't have been. They're not distributing themselves, and there's some kind of information gap. And it's reflected in this essentially entropic information metric that we've defined for sampling performance. So in a way, this whole picture is posing the problem, you know, how can we do better if we use this metric of what does it mean to collect data in an optimal way? How can we do better, or how can we do it in a systematic way so that we're sure we're doing the best we can given our resources?
So they're just randomly going around?
No, they're not randomly going around. So we have two oceanographers who run these things. One guy had five guys that are basically going back and forth on lines. When you saw this first dip, what happened was one of those gliders, for some reason, he wasn't trying to coordinate them. One of them just sort of, for some reason, almost crashed into another one. And then the other guy had he's got shallow water gliders, and they were moving around these kind of trapezoidal tracks. And they're well planned out. They have their different reasons for doing what they do, but they weren't thinking about the coordination problem. I mean, in the middle of the experiment, they said, Naomi, can you figure out how to make sure the gliders don't come across each other, because it ruins the whole story. So
how does your information measure penalize you for missing regions? I mean, it's obvious how it penalizes you if two things come close together, but that's redundant. How does it penalize you if you just miss a region altogether?
Well, I mean, look what the information, look what uncertainty looks like.
No, I understand, but how does this phi of A or whatever it is, because that penalizes you for missing a region also somehow?
Yes, so phi is essentially, you can think about it as the average, or maybe one over the average of the value, if you average the uncertainty over the whole area, something like the inverse of that is the...
But the area is bounded? Because the area is unbounded, then each one can just go off.
No, the area is bounded. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and so here is what we're doing now, sort of motivation, and now this is actually a virtual pilot experiment that we ran in January 2006. Mm-hmm. So we just ran this. This is how many gliders? 10 gliders. I showed you the picture at the beginning. It's the same picture, but now you see the error map. So it's this grayscale, which is the error map. So the error is low, right where these guys are, and it's, you know, you get some error in the center because we're basically having them go around these racetracks. But the idea here is that they're being coordinated a certain way. You can see kind of some of these guys, there's three around here and there's three around here, and there's pairs that are all synchronized as they move around. Okay, so this notion of trying to do patterns where synchrony plays a role. I mean, this notion of trying to understand how to sort of simply parameterize patterns so that we can systematically come up with algorithms to facilitate stable control, robust control over these kinds of patterns is sort of what this is all about. Okay, so on the natural system side, which I'm showing a picture that everybody saw yesterday from Danny's experiments. So this is one of his, you remember he showed us a bunch of different experiments where he put fish in this one cubic meter tank, and he tracks them and he shows us their trajectories. And so one of the things that I want to talk about in the context of the same work that we're using to synthesize these patterns is how one can potentially think about problems like analyzing data. So when you have a parameterized family of patterns, how might you even think about distinguishing various kinds of behaviors in the animal movements, or even sort of reverse engineering. So if something here looks like a pattern, we can reverse engineer and tell you, at least in the context of our simple model, where we can say, we can prove some things about structure and stability, what you might expect could happen. Okay, so this work that I'm going to now describe, again, is with Derek Paley and Rodolphe Sapolker. And the goal is to achieve synchrony of many individually controlled dynamical systems. And the real problem is, you know, how should they be interconnected? Interconnection, who's sensing who and how are they responding is the question. How do you do that for a desired level of synchrony? So when I talk about a parameterized family, the parameters are really going to correspond to different notions, different levels of synchrony, which I'll explain. But because here we're really focused on interconnection synchrony, it's quite reasonable, we believe, to think about using simplified models for the individuals, both from the practical point of view, since that's the sort of the way we have to actually control them, but also from the point of view of focusing in on a synchrony. And of course, there's lots of precedent for this, and sort of the famous examples that we heard about yesterday from Emma about all the systems that have been studied using these simple models of coupled phase oscillators. One of the other nice attributes of these interconnected systems is that they have this high level of symmetry, so reduction techniques from geometric control can actually be quite useful in this context. So I am going to talk about a particle model, so each individual agent is going to be modeled as a particle. And this model follows the work of Eric Just, who's here and will talk tomorrow, and Krishna Prasad. So essentially, I'm going to talk about a planar model today. And so each individual is moving around in the plane. Each red circle here is one of these individuals. Rk is the position of a particle, and theta k is its heading direction. And for convenience, we actually, instead of thinking about this as the real plane, we think about it as the complex plane. So we write the position as a complex number. And we're going to assume that each of these guys is moving at unit speed. Okay, so these are going to be these self-propelled particles, and all we're going to be able to do is control their heading. Okay, so their speed looks, as a complex number, just looks like e to the ik, so cosine theta k plus I sine k theta. So it's moving in the direction of theta k at speed equal to 1. Right, so then the positions look like a complex, like n vehicles, complex vector, and all the headings, the collection of headings, live on the n torus, so I have n angles. And so then the very simple steering model looks like this. So rk dot is just this velocity in the direction theta k, and theta k dot is what we can control. We can control the steering rate of each guy. So if I make the control 0, then the guy just moves in the direction that it started heading in. If I give it some constant, say omega naught, then it basically turns around in a circle of radius 1 over.
Can I ask a quick question about control? To think of this in terms of the vehicles that you have?
Yeah.
You are able to continuously control the vehicles?
No, so what I was trying to say was that what we actually do is we're in the underwater setting is that we run on our onshore computer what we call the planner. So it's constantly sort of running a simulation of what it thinks is going on. And anytime somebody comes up and gives it new information, that gets fed back into the model. And anytime somebody comes up ready for new instructions, it gives it kind of like a 2-hour, discretized version of where it should go. And then the low-level control takes over and falls.
This is not using the ocean model that you were talking about earlier.
Yes. So when we run even our virtual, we have now a simulation test bed to do virtual experiments. So we run in a virtual ocean. So we run in the 2003 ocean that the Harvard model produced. So we run in the flow fields that are pretty challenging, and we run and we sample temperature fields, and the riders have to face the currents. We do all this, and we do it via the crazy way that these guys communicate to us. So we post profiles, scripts, and what's whole, and then we feed that back from the website.
You're banking on those models being pretty good.
Which models?
Ocean current prediction models that you're using to forecast where
No, we're not using the forecasts. We're not using the forecasts. Not yet.
When you get the data from up there.
The satellites are up there.
is it time independent when you get one shot of data on the AUV surfaces, it requires some data or target, and then it tries to go to that target? It's like a waypoint?
It's following waypoints once it's underwater. When it comes to the surface, it gets GPS, and it sends back its profile, it gets its new mission, then underwater.
The data that it takes underwater with it is a fixed, time-independent thing.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it's a whole cycle old. So these guys don't necessarily want us to do any kind of computation on the surface. So it's actually has to be waiting for it before we get that new information from it. So we have all these delays.
And this information is independent of the other AUVs, is that really is, or is it not?
Well, what it gets is the result of this planning algorithm, which is what it should be doing, given that everybody is where we think they are. But what it gives us is just where it is and what it thinks the average current is. We use what it thinks the average current is, its own measurement. So just for notation, RJK refers to the relative position between the J and K particle. Theta JK is the relative heading. And so if we pick a control law that depends only on relative positions and relative headings, and the fact that we can think about this as just control over the shape, because the dynamics don't then depend upon where the whole group is or how the whole group is oriented. So that we have a rigid motion, a rigid body symmetry related to the whole group. It's just a controller that's controlling the shape of the collective. And so if you look at the dynamics on this kind of space of relative positions and orientations, then Eric and Krishna showed that the fixed points, so the equilibria down there in this space, are correspond to parallel trajectories of the group or motions of the group around, all of them around the very same circle. Okay, so it's indeed these kinds of motions that the kinds of patterns that we synthesize, circular motion and parallel motion. Okay, so here's sort of a central idea of where we take this and how we get to the point of being able to doing the systematic synthesis. And it's by taking this notion of coupled phase oscillator model. So if I just, for instance, think about the equation for the headings of all these, I'm actually going to think about these headings as oscillators. So instead of talking about, like Emma talked yesterday, about activity on-off, now the heading is actually connected to the spatial dynamics of these particles, right? Because if it's turning, the guy is moving in this direction or in that direction. So UK, if I split it into two parts, one you could think plays the role of the one that depends on both relative position and relative heading, depends upon, could sort of play the role of the natural frequency, and F would play the role of the coupling between the oscillators. And then I have the spatial dynamics here too, right? So it's sort of an extension of a coupled phase oscillator model. And there's really nice analogies. So synchronized orientation, if they're all heading in the same direction, corresponds to the parallel motion of our group. If they're anti-synchronized, so picture just two particles with some constant natural frequency and opposite headings, they're basically going to be moving around a circle with one another on the opposite sides of the circle. Okay, so we're going to assume that each individual is identical here. We don't want leaders, because if our leader, these gliders, something happens to them, if the leader will screw up the rest of the group. So the whole, homogeneity among the individuals is important in terms of robustness for us. So, but of course, they're not identical for real, but there is some precedent for thinking about synchrony being robust to individual discrepancies. So, for instance, all of the analysis has been done in this Kuramoto model for coupled phase oscillators. Okay, so so from the coupled phase oscillator literature, there's a very nice notion that essentially gives you a measure of synchrony. If you write down, so this is a circle in the complex plane. I'm just plotting the angles around the circle of all my individuals in the group. Okay, so then I'm going to define this thing P theta, which is just the phasor that's the centroid of all these phasors. Okay, so P theta here is the average of all the vectors pointing to all these different headings. So I can sum it like this. Interestingly enough, remember EI theta k, these phasors are actually the velocities of each of these individuals. So if you think about them as all unit mass particles, then the linear momentum, the time derivative of the linear time derivative of the center of mass of the group, which is the average linear momentum of the group, is essentially the same thing p theta. And that makes perfect sense. I mean, it's consistent with this analogy that we just said, right? Because, well, I'll show you in a second, but you know, the idea is this: the magnitude of this thing is gives us a sense of, you could call it phase coherence, or it's also a measure of synchrony. Because if they're all heading in the same direction, it has magnitude one. If the headings are all distributed around the circle so that they balance out, the magnitude is zero. And this magnitude is equal to the average, the magnitude of the linear momentum. So synchronized means maximal linear momentum. The balanced case when they're all around means zero linear momentum, and the center of mass of the group will be fixed. So here's a little picture just to show that. Here, all the angles are lined up to be the same. The group, you know, linear momentum, they're all synchronized. Now they're balanced around so that the centroid is actually at zero. These guys are moving around in a circle with all their guys, the angles balanced such that the center of mass is fixed. Okay, so this is how we get to a design methodology, because you can think about, you know, this P theta as being a parameter that we want to control, right? If we want to be able to switch between a kind of polarized motion and a, you know, a resting motion where the center of the mass stays fixed, then let's think about a potential that's something like P theta squared, right? Because it's maximal for the synchronized phases and it's minimal for these balanced phases. So if we choose a control law that's like the gradient of this thing, depending upon the sign, so here I'm going to use UK to be a constant times the gradient of this thing, I can drive either up to its maximum or to its minimum. I can control whether I get polarized or this kind of circular motion. And of course, the gradient is the sum of the sinusoids of the differences. So if I pick a control law that looks like some constant natural frequency plus this gradient, it looks like the, you know, sort of a simplified version of the Kuramoto model for a coupled oscillators. We have here I have identical natural frequency. And so, because this is a gradient system, one gets a pretty straightforward stability result, because this potential plays the role of a Lyapunov function, and one can prove, depending upon the sign, that your solutions, in this case, we can show that all solutions converge to the synchronized case when K1 is negative, and when K1 is positive, they converge to this balanced set. Every other critical point is unstable. So here's kind of a picture of this. Omega naught, zero. So we expect straight line motion. Here's the case when K1 is negative. So we're going to the synchronized state. So here they are all moving off together, sort of at maximum momentum. When K1 is positive, they're, in this case, they're moving away from one another, but the center of mass gets stabilized, so it's fixed. If we turn on some natural frequency, so non-zero omega naught, now they move around in circles, but here, all it's kind of crazy, they're all doing this, when they're all, no, they're doing this, right? But they're synchronized as they do it. Their headings are always the same. And now this one looks really crazy, but the angles, the headings, are all balanced around the circle, so the center of mass is fixed. Of course, we want to make a little bit more sense out of this, because we really, what we want in the end is to get them in one of these relative equilibria where they move on the same circle. I'll talk about that. Yeah.
You're assuming all four of them.
No, that's going to be part of the story. In this picture, yes, but I want to show you how we generalize. So this is the lead into my slide, is that from this sort of example of how you might design, polarized versus circular motion, we can come up with a design methodology to think about a whole family of stabilizable collectives. So where synchrony is measured by relative phasing, so we don't necessarily want them all synchronized for this kind of arbitrary balance, but we might want various kinds of patterns. And I'll show you how we design, for instance, how we isolate these balance patterns so that maybe you have clusters of equal number of individuals around a given circle rather than just some arbitrarily balanced headings. And we also think about synchrony in the spacing. So for instance, making all the centers of those circles coincide so that they move around the same circle. And we do this in a general way so that we can define, we generalize what I call the U1, this P theta squared, so that it's Laplacian dependent. So it depends on the interconnection topology, who's sensing who. But the end result is this parameterized family of stabilizable collective, which we can use on the engineering side, so we can optimize over these parameters or potentially do some reverse engineering on the biology side. So people have talked about this, so I won't belabor it, but the notion of using a graph comes into play here for describing the interconnection topology. So in each individual particle is a node on the graph, and every time two individuals can communicate with one another, we draw an edge. And then one can define a variety of matrices from graph theory, the adjacency matrix, where you stick a 1 every time two guys are sensing one another, and a 0 otherwise. The valence matrix tells you, in this case of a ring. So here I have 9 nodes. Individual 1 is talking to 2 and 9. Individual 2 is talking to 1 and 3. Individual 3 is talking to 2 and 4, et cetera. So the valence talks about how many edges to each node. In this case, it's 2 for every node. And this is another matrix called the incidence matrix. From these matrices, you can define what's known as the Laplacian, which is that valence minus the adjacency matrix. And this, in this talk, I'm going to limit myself to undirected graphs. So when one guy senses it, another individual, he senses him back. So it's bidirectional sensing or communication. We have some newer results that generalize this to directed graphs and also to time-varying graphs. I'm going to look only at, in the context of what we can prove here, I'm only going to look at fixed graphs for the moment. So in that case, of a directed, undirected graph, if the graph is connected, meaning that there's a path from every individual to every other individual, which I'm also going to assume here, so connected, undirected, fixed graphs, the vector of all ones is an eigenvector of L. It has rank n minus 1, so the only zero eigenvalue, there's only one zero eigenvalue, and this is the corresponding eigenvector. So we can define a quadratic form on this space of complex vectors, n vectors, which looks like this. So the real part of complex conjugate of z times the Laplacian times z. And so on the reduced space, if we reduce out this this symmetry direction, which corresponds to rigid displacements of our group, this is a well-defined norm. So this is, you can see this in, for example, in Reza Al-Fati and Richard Murray's paper. Here's the Laplacian in the case of a ring. You can also think about this as the sum of the squares of the distances between all interconnected elements in the Z matrix, in the Z vector. Okay, so here's the generalization of U1. I'm calling it W1, which is essentially, we call this the phase potential. So we're applying this norm not to a vector position here. We're defining it in terms of this vector that defines the different directions of our n particles. Okay, so here's W1, its potential. In the case of a complete graph, it's equivalent to this U1 that I was describing, this P theta squared, well, it's minus P theta squared, plus a constant. So this thing will be maximized when the center of mass is fixed and minimized when it's synchronized. And so here's the generalized version of what the gradient looks like. So now you sum over the signs, but only where there is a neighbor to actually show up here. And so you would choose a control to be analogous, that's omega naught, some constant, plus some constant times this gradient. And again, you can show that the phases converge to the critical points of this guy, and the synchronized state is one. And if the graph is circulant, so meaning that the Laplacian is a circulant matrix, then these balanced critical points exist. Okay, so if just an example of the ring, you know, the control law looks like, you know, sine of the relative heading, you and your neighbor, one above and one down, the two neighbors that you talk to. And you can set, you can, in this case of the ring, it's really easy to solve for all the equilibria and prove that you have exponential, local exponential stability in the case only when all of the relative angles of these communicating pairs is the same number. And you can even say when it's stable, when K1, the constant that you use, times the cosine of that difference is negative. So for instance, here are all the possible solutions in the case of a ring. So this is the unit circle, these are headings. So when they're all synchronized, or when the angle, in this case of 9, so this is what, 2 pi divided by 9, this is 4 pi divided by 9, these are all less than pi over 2. Using negative k gives me exponential stability of these and instability of these. If I change the sign of my gain, then I get stability of this kind of pattern or this kind of pattern, depending upon my initial conditions. Okay, so we use the same norm to talk not just about synchrony of the headings, but also this kind of spatial synchrony. So I know how to, you know, balance headings and synchronize headings, for instance, but now I want to make them all move around a circle. So I really want to, in the spatial dynamics, create these patterns. So I use the same norm, except now instead of looking at the e to the I theta, which is the vector of all the velocities, I look at the vector that consists of the centers of all of the different circles. So all these guys are moving around their own circles, and I want those to coincide. And so this thing is minimized when C is also, every single component is equal, so it's a multiple of the one vector, right? So this is exactly what I want. I play the same game. If you take ddt of this thing, I want this thing to, along the equations of motion, to go to this minimum. So I pick a gradient control, which ends up looking like this. So again, this is depending upon my interconnection topology, I'll get a different rule here. But I can show that if I choose my control this way, because it's a gradient system, I'll have this kind of convergence. And so sure enough, you can prove that you get these, in fact, globally asymptotically stable and locally exponential stable collective motion all around the same circle. We want to put the two together, so we write down an energy-like function on the Lyapunov function that sums this potential that's a function of the center circles and another potential that's a function of all the relative headings, so that we do kind of this phasing and spacing. So we can get them to move around a circle, for instance, and we can design, in this case, we can get them all to move synchronized around the circle or all to move in this kind of balanced way around the circle. Yeah.
Well, this global stability, but you're still considering that the communication network is fixed.
I'm only going to talk about fixed. We have some results on time varying, okay. So ones that might be generated from neighborhoods
and
things like that.
In this case, they're moving and they're changing the phase and everything, but you still...
We have a fixed...
You're always
exactly
talking to the same one.
I'll show you in a minute what we've been doing with Danny, which is to try out... switching topologies or near neighbor topologies. But what I'm going to show you in the context of just showing you proofs is fixed.
And what fixes the radius of the circle in this case?
It's the speed.
It's just the speed.
Right. So we can prove these kinds of results that you can get the synchronized circular formation or these balanced formations by using this sort of composite of the two kinds of potentials. So here's an example in the case of a ring. So each individual is communicating with exactly two others in the group. And I don't know if there's 12 individuals in this case. So in the case when I pick, so I'm using both potentials to make the move on a circle and to control their what their relative phases are doing. So when K1 is negative, that's the synchronized case. And here enough, you see sure enough that they're all moving around. They converge on the circle where they're all moving at the same, in fact, the same place around the same circle. In this case, when K1 is greater than 0, I got this pattern. I mean, this was an initial condition dependent because you remember for K1 positive, there's a couple different possibilities. But here they are all moving around the circle. All 12 of them are uniformly distributed around the circle as they move. And the center of mass, sure enough, is fixed. In this case, I picked K1 equals 0, so I'm not using the heading synchrony. So all I'm getting is these guys moving around the circle, but sure enough, the center of mass isn't fixed, and they're not synchronized. I'm not getting either one because I've turned that part off. Okay. So we take this a step further because we want to do more than just balanced and polarized. We want to actually be able to design patterns. So for instance, in the context of these circular motions, like I said, we want to think about, for instance, the symmetric patterns, so evenly spaced, evenly sized clusters moving around a circle. And so we want to isolate certain, those are all these balanced patterns, is sort of a high-dimensional space of these balanced patterns. And we do this by looking at higher harmonics of phase differences in the coupling. So we have a generalization. This generalizes with the W's, but I'm going to show you in the case of complete graphs how we think about this. So this is a generalization of that thing I call P theta, right? You can define PM theta, which is the sum of the phasors of e to the I M theta k. So we're looking at these higher moments. So for instance, here is the case of N individuals. P theta is equal to 1 when they're all synchronized. When 2 are here and 2 are here, P theta is equal to 0, but 2 times P theta, 2 theta is equal to 1. It's like multiplying these by 2 and they'll end up at the same place. In the case of taking them and uniformly distributing around the circle, P theta 0, right, because it's balanced, 2P2 theta 0. So multiplied by 2, it looks like a balanced pattern. But when I multiply by 4, I get them all, they're all synchronized. So these are the the parameters that I can associate with these different patterns. So these are going to be the parameters that are going to dictate what the patterns look like and also what the control laws. So kind of like, let me show you. So the idea, you know, if I want to control, you know, if I want to get this pattern, I should make these guys go to 0 and this guy go to 1. So I can do that by summing potentials that look like, you know, generalization of what I did with P theta, but now I'm going to play the game with the PM theta. So I'm going to make them go to 0, you know, zeros and ones as appropriate to get the right kind of pattern. And if you look at the gradients of these kinds of things, they're what you'd expect. The sinusoids of M times the relative, the higher harmonics, relative heading. So you can prove this very nice result. If you define an MN pattern to be a pattern of, you have M particles, M clusters of uniformly spaced, each cluster has N minus M phases in it. Okay, so here's an example for N equal 12. That's the 1N pattern, one cluster of 12. Here's this is called the splay state, or the N pattern, so that's 12 clusters of 1 each, and I have 2 clusters of 6, 3 of 4, 4 of 3, 6 of 2. And so I create a potential that's the sum of all these guys, and if I play the game right, I pick the sign of the first M minus 1, so I'm going to drive those corresponding P's to 0, and the other guy, so I drive it to 1, I'll get the right pattern. Sure enough, you can prove that the pattern is equivalent to the global minimum of this potential, so you can use the same trick, write down the control law that corresponds to the gradient law. And so here's the example in the complete graph where I'm doing the spacing thing and I'm doing this gradient thing, and I'm showing you the same control law where all I'm doing is changing basically the value of M, which gives me slightly different patterns. And so here are, for the case of N equal 12, the 6 different symmetric patterns. So it's the same control law with slightly different choices of those parameters so that we get the different patterns. So the one pattern you're going to see, the synchronized pattern is top left, the splay in the bottom right, and get all the ones in between.
I
So we've taken this a little bit further. I'm going to just show you a couple of examples of how we extend this to make it somewhat more practical. So in the ocean, you saw we weren't actually moving around circles, and we weren't moving around one circle. So we've done some interesting things where, for example, instead of setting up the interconnection topology so that it's the same for headings and for spacings, we have two different interconnection topologies. So for instance, we might want all of the headings to be coupled, like in these kinds of clusters, but we might want to have only subgroups care about being on the same circle. And so we have interconnection topologies that can assign, you know, subgroups to want to be around the same circle, but still couple all the headings so that we can synchronize individuals, even though they're on different circles, they might want to be synchronized or anti-synchronized. Because that we care about how, I mean, for us in the ocean, when we're trying to come up with this pattern, it really matters where everybody is relative to one another. And this notion of relative phases is a very straightforward and simple way to parameterize relative positions around these kind of structured curves. So let me show you this movie. Right, so this is the generalization of what you saw. So it has a few generalizations. There are multiple curves. That, let's see, what are we doing? This is like four clusters of three each, right, in headings, but then there's three subgroups. We've also introduced some symmetry breaking here in the sense that we have a beacon for this group, a beacon for this group, and a beacon for this group. So now they're trying to circle a particular place. So for the ocean application, that's important that we actually put it somewhere in space. And then we've also extended to this these other than circular curves so that we can do things like, in this case, there was a sort of a super ellipse, like a rounded rectangle. And there you have to be careful because, you know, now, you know, you don't just give it a constant curvature. You have to give it a variable curvature to move around a curve that's not a circle. Here's just another idea where if you're interested in following some kind of, in this case, piecewise linear trajectory, you might want to concatenate this notion of, you know, sort of resting and then traveling and then resting and traveling, and that's what's going on here. And in this case, it's sort of expanding. We change the speed, and we can change the radius of these things, of the circle. Okay, so the last 5 minutes, I want to talk about what we've been doing on the biology side. So here the idea is to think about this phase potential, W1 of theta. Remember, this was the thing that was zero in the synchronized state and one in this kind of balanced state where the center of mass of the group was fixed. And use it as a way to maybe infer some information from, in this case, the fish data about distinguishing different levels of synchrony. So for instance, Danny talked about his four fish experiment. Now this is just all the trajectories from that four fish experiment over, I guess this is like a 10-minute period of it. And, you know, it kind of looks a mess. But when you look at the movie, you know, you really can see when he says this is the polarized group that it's quite polarized. And, you know, this guy is the tight milling group. And you can even see it here. And you can see this is the diffuse milling group. And so the question is, what happens if you compute this potential for these various experiments? Can you say something about some underlying structure, even though, of course, they're not exactly in any of these patterns? So this is what we set out to do. And we tried various ways of modeling the sensory graphs. So we tried first to put in the full kind of zone model that Ian and Danny talked about, including so here's the zone model. These guys have this zone around them where if you're in that zone, then they're going to try to align with one another. This kind of the back 60 degrees that they can't see anybody. And we computed under that kind of switching interconnection graph the values of W1. So preliminary results I'm not going to show you because what we found was actually because we kind of get low values of the potential, not because they're synchronized, but because they're very weakly connected. Basically, in this case, no one was ever really talking to each other, so we're basically getting zero for the potential, which isn't so meaningful in the context of trying to sort out synchrony. But what I am going to show you is what we did with a slightly different interconnection choice. In this case, We are looking at the sensory graph where each individual is always communicating with somebody, and that's defined by how many. We ran a couple cases, so we fixed the number of neighbors. So you're always going to talk to, unless it's really close, we assume that's repulsion, then we'll go to the next neighbor out. But so we basically looked over a 10-minute period of data and computed, so here's a histogram. In the case at the top of the complete graph, where you're looking at n minus 1, all your neighbors, and then in the case where you're just looking at your nearest neighbor, what the value of this potential would be. And so here's the frequency of the value of the potential from 0, which is synchronized, to 1, which is fixed center of mass. So this is the four fish experiment. This is what the data looks like. The blue shows you when they're talking with, let me just show you what this plot is telling you. This plot shows you, so here's a peak. This is the polarized group, and you would expect, and we did see, a peak here at, you know, actually close to 0, which is the synchronized state, all four of them living together. What I found particularly happy result was that this other peak, there was a definite peak right there, and it's at 0.75. If you compute what 0.75 is, it's three guys going one way and one guy going the other way. It's precisely what you see in this polarized group when they're moving around. When they're not all synchronized, one guy's kind of doing something else. He turns around and goes the other way, and then they come back together. So that they spend most of their time either synchronized or three and one sort of moving in the direction. That's what the peak corresponds to. In the tight milling case, the peak is over here. In the case when you're looking at all your neighbors, of essentially, you know, center of mass being fixed, right, this milling group. Likewise, so independent of tight versus diffusing, milling seems to suggest, again, center of mass fixed. When we look at the nearest neighbor, however, this sort of a significant, you know, as you might expect, more synchrony going on. They're synchronizing with their close neighbors, but with respect to the group, there's this you know, abundance of trying to sort of stay as an activity that the whole group is doing at a given place. So this is sort of where we are with this, and it's been inspiring and exciting, so I hope we'll go further with that. We're doing some other things, which I don't have time to tell you, related to some of the stuff that Ian talked about yesterday, where individuals in the group have some information, so preferred directions, and trying to, in our case, see if we can use this very simple model to compute or predict some of the bifurcations that they were seeing. For instance, when the preferred directions, the difference between the preferred directions were growing, they saw a bifurcation from, you know, wanting to split the difference to wanting to go one way or the other. So we're studying that with these kinds of oscillator type models, you know, doing things like exploring phase space. In fact, in the case where we have, you know, a representative from each of the preferred direction group, we can show you later, we can find all the equilibria and prove some really neat bifurcations in there. This is not the same bifurcation that Ian sees, so we have more work to do to understand some more of the complexity in the model. But my time's up, so I just want to conclude by saying, you know, what the message was this, trying to come up with some tools so that we could have a way to systematically synthesize collective motions, but in this sort of parameterized family that we have defined. And so on the engineering side, that gives us lots of opportunities to think about, you know, optimizing. So in our case, optimizing for sampling performance over these kinds of parameters, and also thinking about, you know, in the context of constraints on energy and communication and some of the things that I haven't talked about, which are these challenges of dealing with the flow field. On the biology side, we hope that this formalism is suggesting, you know, new ways for us to think about how we might go about interpreting some of this biological data. So, you know, thinking about it as compared to these, although idealized, they're understandable, and we can sort of say something in a provable way about what they give you. And so, you know, the hope is that, you know, we can tie these kinds of analytical results to some reasonable biological models. And I think everybody is hoping to think about these kinds of problems in in, you know, the harder problems of large and heterogeneous and multi-scale 3D everything kinds of groups. But I think we'll hear more about that as the week goes on. So thank you very much.